Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap. Like old women with no children, holding hands with a cluck. Comfort and courage found in bottles of whiskey. And wondering if every well I've drilled has gone dry.
I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed a car. I'll be down a road in a cloud of smoke to some land.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
On back.
No, every well you drilled didn't go dry, because we got a big mud truck and we're going to frack this baby. Speaking of fracking, ladies and gentlemen, this is Vinyl Tap, where we frack an album almost once a week. I'm joined by Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Hello, Tapsters.
Our lovely producer. And I'm also joined by T, also known as Tony.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And we have Archer.
And we have Archer. We're hoping you won't hear too much from Archer today. Archer is not the poorly behaved cartoon character, but actually this is a puppy dog. Yes. And if you're a girl out there, if you're one of the three or four girls that listens to this program, it's a cute puppy dog. Yep. So you ought to be very happy about that and us more.
He's the This Is Vinyl Tap mascot.
All right.
I thought Doug was the This Is Vinyl Tap mascot.
I have too much gravitas to be a mascot. So, we're back in Texas, but not for very long. unfortunate things about the guy we're talking about tonight is that he's one of these Texans. And I'm going to struggle with this tonight, guys. He never told Nashville to go to hell.
No. I don't know if I agree 100% with that.
Yeah.
Well, but if he did, it slipped past my research. Okay,
let me ask you this, since you brought that up, not to be too antagonistic. Did Waylon tell Nashville to go to hell?
Well, he pulled a gun out on session players. I think that counts.
But he never left the town.
Well, he wrote a song about not liking the...
Yeah, well, I think Waylon did raise enough hell to get him out of there, but we have our other problem with Waylon, and it's not buried in Texas, which is very difficult. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, there's a chance that some of the people listening to this program are not Texans and are not suffering with the same problems and hangups that we have. We have tonight Guy Clark, his first album. Notice how I didn't say debut, because I've learned how not to say that. His first album, Old Number One. Guy Clark is in the pantheon of Texas singer-songwriters that we all are. I guess he would come up pretty quickly if you started a list. Jonathan J.M. Rowe,
yes.
You've lived in almost every part of Texas.
Yep.
If you were to make the Mount Rushmore of Texas singer-songwriters, that weren't gigantic phenomenons like Waylon or
Willie.
Who would you put in that category on Mount Rushmore? Mount Songwritemore.
Well, does Kris Kristofferson count as one of the big ones?
I don't think so.
Definitely have to put him up.
I think he's too big.
Okay, I would say you got to put Townes Van Zandt up there.
Townes.
You know, this is going to surprise you. I think you could possibly put Robert O'Keefe up there for his his Robert first album, first couple of albums. Let's see. You got to put, well, the guy we're talking about today, you got to put Guy Clark up there. And maybe Jerry Jeff Walker, although he's from New York, so I don't know if you could count him.
JM's missing one huge one. Would you like to chime in?
Hank Williams.
Hank Williams.
Hank Williams.
There must be another one. How about Billy Joe Schaefer?
Oh yeah, obviously.
Billy Joe Schaefer. How did I miss that one?
Yeah,
yeah.
And there's more that we're not thinking of right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, he is a highly revered Guy Clark. That is a highly revered singer and songwriter, and was palled around and was friends with most of the people we just mentioned.
Yeah,
and we got a pretty good album here. It's highly rated by most people. The songs, most of these people have heard these songs probably from somebody else. Before he could get Desperados, what was it, L.A. Freeway that showed up on Viva Tolingua before?
No. L.A. Freeways was on Jerry Jeff Walker's debut for Decca.
So almost everybody has heard these songs. Most people have heard them by somebody else.
Yeah.
Yep.
The maybe the biggest hit he had was a number 15 hit with the Highwaymen.
Doing Desperados.
Desperados.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a connection.
It is. Wow, we're sliding in early, huh? That's amazing.
Yeah. Here's an example of a. Of some music that's not like Guy Clark. Doobie, doobie, doobie. Although the doobies are probably the same.
Probably.
Yeah.
Jonathan J.M. Rowe, would you have a connection with us? Let me explain the connection first of all. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a little game we play among the three of us, and we hope that you play along there in your comfort of your own home. We tried to connect this artist and this album with previous artists and albums that we have done on this program. And Jonathan, you're going to go first and give us a good connection.
Okay. David Briggs, the piano player.
Okay. I give up.
He played on Naturally by John Cale.
Oh, cool.
Or J.J. Cale, not John Cale.
He's a
very different artist.
Yeah. And he piano and sings back up on this one, on old number one.
Yeah.
T?
Well, do I go with an easy one?
No, you should go with a hard one because I need the easy ones.
Okay, I'm going to same person, so I'm going to name two people. The same person connects both of them. Kris Kristofferson, his album we did, and Honky Tonk Masquerade by Joe Ely.
Yep.
Chip Young plays guitar on both of those.
Is that right?
Yep. Yeah.
And the other connection with
Kris Kristofferson
is that... That had influence on getting him to Nashville.
Right.
Well, there's one other Kris Kristofferson connection.
What's that?
The backup singer, Sammy Smith.
Oh, okay.
She was the original singer of Help Me Make It Through the Night.
Oh.
Well, there you go.
Yep.
All right.
I have a connection. I don't know if you guys got this one. This is pretty esoteric. Towns Van Zandt.
What's the connection there?
Yeah.
They were best friends. They both kind of shared his wife in a way, and he lived with Guy and Susan for a while.
There's also a direct connection to the Towns Van Zandt album we did.
Aha.
Which also connects him to Redheaded Stranger.
Yes.
Mickey Raphael plays Mickey harmonica on both those albums and on this album.
I didn't even hear him on this one.
You don't really?
I think I must not have been thinking about it.
What on earth are you talking about?
Nobody plays a harmonica like that guy.
I know. That's why I was surprised.
Yeah. So obvious. But
I thought it was Bob Dylan.
I think if there was an acoustic guitar on an album in the 70s, Mickey Raphael was probably on it.
World famous harmonica player. I guess he's best known for being part of the Willie family band.
Yeah.
Even though they don't look like family. Speaking of Willie, Bobby died. I didn't know that.
Yeah. A couple years
Bobby
ago.
Nelson died. Mm-hmm. That was a while ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple years
ago. Okay. I guess my news is a little slow. Any more connections?
Do you have any, Doug?
Well, that was it, man. I've got a couple more later.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jonathan J. Amro.
I'm going to go with the obvious one. Emmylou Harris. She sings on this album. We did an album by her.
Oh, that's right.
There's a couple of other connections.
Is Rodney Crowell on this album?
Rodney Crowell is on this album, yeah. And so is another Texas singer-songwriter who was not at all famous at this point.
Steve Earle.
Steve Earle.
Steve Earle. How about Johnny Gimble?
Yep. World-famous fiddle player.
He played on Riding High, the Jerry Jeff Walker album we did. And Jerry Jeff Walker is a connection because, just in general, outside of that, because he's connected to this guy pretty
much. And he's made him a lot of money, I would imagine. They've made each other a lot of money.
Johnny Gimble was also a Texas Playboy.
He was.
We can't get that. Yep.
He was a later incarnation of him.
And that's Bob Wilson, the Texas Playboys, for anybody from California who might have just joined us.
It is kind of remarkable that, when we get to the talking about the album and how this album was crafted, how it's essentially a bunch of demos with some pretty amazing session people on it.
Yeah, it is.
It's remarkable, but anyway. Yeah.
It is one of, it has a spare sound, even when there's a lot of instruments on it.
Yeah.
So that goes back to your comment about essentially giving the finger to Nashville, because when this was recorded the first time, that's not what it sounded like. And he put his foot down and said, I'm not doing this. So, I mean, yeah, he'd stayed in Nashville, but I think he
certainly never became Nashvilleized. His wife wrote a big hit for Nashville. That may have been number one. I don't know. It's that you got to dance like nobody's watching. What's that?
Like you don't need the money, love. Like you'll never get hurt. You got to dance. Like nobody's watching. It's gotta come from the heart if you want it to work.
Yeah, Susanna Clark had a little bit better success in terms of the hits than Guy did. Guy was more enduring than she was, but she scored bigger hits than he did.
Yeah. And it's pretty evident why.
Well,
there's a limit to what can be played on commercial country radio. No,
I get you.
She fits inside that box, and Guy is definitely outside.
But if you compare him to somebody like Kris Kristofferson, which I think you can.
Yeah.
Kris Kristofferson scored huge hits for people. And it is a bit of a head scratcher how some of these Guy Clark songs weren't bigger hits than they were. Maybe they weren't recorded by people like
Kristofferson's songs are more universal.
Well, Johnny Cash did record songs for him.
Yeah.
Guy Clark's songs are pretty particular.
They're very personal.
Yeah. Well, they talk about
big people could have done some of these songs, but very few of them have a little catchy hook for you.
Yeah, but when they do, they drill into your brain and bounce around. One song in particular on
that old time feeling will get into your head. I think
Rita Blue's another one that just sits there and bounces around inside your skull for a while.
Yeah,
but I think when we talk about singer songwriters, in my mind, he's the closest to Kristofferson of the other ones.
I think so, especially the subject matter.
I saw Rodney Crowell being interviewed about this, and he talked about how he was a disciplined worker on his songs. And he said that he's always compared to Towns because the two were together all the time. Mm-hmm. And Rodney Crowell talks about Towns' songs just floated down from somewhere, and nobody could figure out where they came from. I think that's precisely right. Yeah. And these songs, it's again, like I said about Kristofferson, you can see a workman knocking away.
Just some of the wordplay on it, he does a lot. And there's a lot of words in some of these songs.
But they're consciously created. They don't seem to come out of a dream.
Right.
Let's rest on that just for a minute, because I found it interesting doing research for this how much Guy Clark bristled at the term craft or craftsman when people talked about his songwriting. He hated it because he thought what he did was art and poetry, and he never thought that. He said that the problem with the word craft is that it makes it seem like it's by rote rather than inspired, and he felt like what he did was inspired. But I think you're probably onto something, Doug, when you compare him to how Kristofferson wrote songs. I think there is a And if Rodney Crowell, who was very close to the guy, saw that, it's kind of hard to argue that he didn't labor over these things in a way that wasn't like someone like Towns Van Zandt. You know?
Yeah.
And Towns might get mad if we suggest he didn't labor over songs.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, so I'm talking about how they sound. I really can't tell you. But when I hear a song, I try to dissect what's going on in the guy's head.
Yeah.
And where did this verse come from? You know, and this sounds like it wasn't the original verse. This replaced something that wasn't as good, maybe.
I think the other comparison to him and Christopherson is they're very, not only they're literary in what they, the way they write, but they're also very sort of like, they're looking out their window and describing kind of what they see type of songs. You know what I mean?
They are very character driven
and they're very personal, but they're also steeped in their own experience. Like when Christopherson's talking about that Sunday morning, that's something he experienced. Most of the songs on this album are things that that come from Guy Clark's past or stuff.
Yeah. Wildcatting and driving, you know,
think about this. Desperado's Waiting on a Train. Old, the 1947, Texas 1947.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are songs that you can say, I know what this is about. I know where this came from.
Yeah.
With the Towns song, you don't get to do that.
Right.
The closest I can think of is when he talks about Loop and Lil, his parakeets. But the rest of it seems like, it comes from a completely different place where we can't see the origins of the story.
The other fascinating thing about talking about Guy Clark in terms of someone like Towns and Chris Christopherson is not only are all three of them Texans, but they have a very similar background in the sense that they come from very intellectual sort of places. Mm-hmm. They were all three expected to do greater things than what they ended up doing.
Something very different.
Yeah. Some of their parents were more supportive than others. We talked about Chris Christopherson's parents essentially disowning him.
Yeah.
But all of these guys had the brain power, at least, and the intellect to do something very much more sort of staid 9-to-5, like be attorneys or be doctors or whatever.
Yeah.
And they felt compelled to do something else. I find that absolutely fascinating because there's all three of them have, like, they were all very smart. They all excelled as young people, and then they got in the music business, and they were successful at different levels.
Yeah,
but
and they all abandoned something to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Guy Clark probably less than the others because he started so young. He went in Nashville at 19. So
yeah, he was 29.
He was 32 when this album was made in 75. Oh,
I was listening to Steve Earle talk about him. Steve Earle was in Nashville at 19. No,
Guy was old. He started writing songs late too. I think
he moved to Houston and he got. Yeah.
Before we get any more mistakes like that, Tony. Where's this fella start out?
Well, he's born in Monahans, Texas. Where
it's east,
or it's like around Midland.
It's west of Midland.
It's west of Odessa. You keep going.
Yeah,
it's right before you get to Peyote. is in Ward County. A great man who fought for the independence of Texas. He's called Peg Leg Ward because he got a leg blown off when he was fighting the Mexicans for Texas independence. But Monahan is in the Permian Basin.
Mm-hmm. Oil-rich land.
That's the richest oil land in the United States. In fact, I have a friend it's funny. He goes, we sold our surface rights on our ranch. And I said, what?
Yeah.
Goes, well, all the drilling platforms were touching one another, so there was no reason for us to have... to have the surface rights anymore.
Yeah.
So that's he got some nice mailbox money. So this is the oil producing part of Texas where the largest oil field in the United States is.
Yeah.
And that county is a big county. It's over 800 square miles and it has 11,000 people in it. So it's pretty
desolate.
Pretty empty. And there's not a lot of trees.
It's funny that you mentioned Peg Leg Ward because there's a peg leg sort of in this story too. we're talking about Guy's grandma. I don't mean to be rude, but she got her leg amputated when she was young. She got a splinter in it and it got infected and got gangrene. And they actually cut it twice. They cut it off below the knee. They didn't get all the gangrene and they cut it off above the knee. But that woman seems like a real character.
Yeah.
And he grew up in her hotel. Is that?
Yeah. So she's, by the time she's 30, she has this prosthetic leg and she's running a bootleg distillery behind Clark's Lunch. She has a son, one son, Guy's dad, named Ellis, and she raised him by herself because her husband, Frank Clark, who ran, I think he ran a pharmacy, but most of the town people said he was just a drug dealer and a drunk, so he wasn't much involved. So she raised Ellis by herself, sort of. She later opened, the place you're talking, the Clark Hotel, which was this shotgun building with 13 rooms for rent and a small living quarters where the family lived. And that thing catered to what you'd think it would. Oil workers, people coming through. Later,
I think it bears to describe West Texas a little bit. In the oil field, you have these giant expansions and contractions of workers. So you'll have these towns where there'll be a bunch of hotels built in a hurry, and then they disappear.
Yeah.
And then you'll have mobile home parks that break out in a hurry, and then they disappear. Yeah. And I think this hotel probably went through some up and downs like that.
Well, Guy later talks about how there would be people staying there that were just essentially, it was like they were living there. They stayed there till they died almost, you know?
Yeah.
Ellis, her son, was a pretty smart guy. You know, he goes and gets a bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Oklahoma. He works a little bit in the hotel industry in Oklahoma and Dallas, and then he returns to Monahans to work at a gas station to help his mom at the hotel. But he gets married to a girl he meets in Oklahoma City named Pearl Francis Green. He goes off to fight in World War II. This is an important part of the story. While he's away, Pearl and Guy lived with his grandmother in the hotel. So Ellis is off in the war, and they live in the Clark Hotel, and so his mom is busy, obviously, as a single mom. So Guy is essentially raised by his grandmother and her wildcatter boyfriend, a guy by the name of Ellis Jackson or Jack Prigg. And
what's a wildcatter?
It's somebody who works the oil wells.
It's someone who goes out and takes huge risk on a well.
Yeah.
Most of the time they come up dry, but if you hit one, it's a big deal.
Yeah. But this guy, Jack Prigg, is essentially Guy's father figure while he's away, and he's instrumental in Guy Clark's life. I mean, he's a huge an imprint on him as maybe anybody.
And he gives him money for the girls.
Yeah. Gives him his first taste of beer. So Guy's dad, when he comes back, they move to Houston. And his dad goes to law school at the University of Houston, and he does so on this is again importance of Jack Prigg. He does so on the GI Bill and also money he borrowed from Jack. And they live in student housing, and during the summers they go back to Monahans and stay with Guy's grandma. Ellis gets his Guy's dad gets his law license on Guy's 11th birthday in 1952. And this is a kind of a cool thing. He, at the time, I don't know if this is still the case. I didn't have a chance to see it. In 1952 or 53, he had the honor of scoring the highest score ever on the Texas bar exam. It was Guy Clark's dad.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow.
The highest score ever at that point. I don't know if he scored like a perfect score and so he still has that. I don't know. Huh. Anyway, he starts a law practice in Pasadena, but he does not want to live in Houston, which I get.
Yeah.
No offense to people listening in Houston. And so they spend the weekends driving around looking for places to live. They look in the hill country, look all over, and they end up settling in Rockport, which is this little fishing town on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, and near Corpus Christi.
And Guy's dad takes over a law practice for a guy who's retiring. The interesting thing about growing up in that family is they didn't have a TV. And they didn't have a record player. So what they would do is after dinner, they would go retire to the living room and they would read poetry to each other and read stories to each other. And the big emphasis was, Guy had two sisters, I think. The big emphasis was want them to use their imagination and understand that there's more to life than just, you know, stuff that like that. So, again, referring back to Jack Prigg, Guy's third sister, her middle name is Jackson, named after this guy. So the family had a real attachment to this guy. Anyway, again, when they're in Rockport, they're spending winters in the Gulf Coast and summers in Monahans. Guy, that's really where he comes to age. And we talked briefly about this, how he had some things in common with Kris Kristofferson. Really, if you look at his high school degree, now he wasn't, you know, quite as stellar as Kristofferson was when you look at like all the national news he got, but he's a center of the football team and the captain of the football team. He plays guard in basketball. He ran the 100-yard dash. He threw discus in track and field. He won all sorts of science fairs. He joins the Explorers Club when he's a junior class president.
Jeez.
He's a junior year. He's elected vice president of the Explorers post. He works on the weekend of this bay club where he takes guys out to fish and hunt. And he's also at the time gets interested in like making things with wood. He's carving stuff with wood. He's making toys and shelves and things like that. Mm-hmm. But he gets a big break in terms of that. And the reason this is important is because Guy Clark becomes a guitar manufacturer,
a luthier.
And he works at this Rob Roy shipyard where he's able to watch these carpenters work on these shrimp boats, and he learns his craft from doing that.
Is this still in Rockport?
This is still in Rockport, yeah. We need to talk about somebody who's also important, and that's Lola Bonner. You guys know Lola Bonner?
I do not know her.
I don't.
So at some point, Ellis takes on a law partner, this woman named Lola Bonner. She's a UT grad, and she moves to Rockport to be close to her sister. And she ends up being a pretty big influence on Guy Clark. One night at a party at the Clark's house, she gets a piano out and starts playing flamenco guitar and singing Mexican songs. And it blew him away. He'd never seen anything like that before. So she starts to teach him, sort of with her limited knowledge, how to play the guitar. She's also taking him around to various parties. She takes him to this house where a bunch of people would sit around, and this sounds like something that happened in Nashville later when Guy Clark was there, where people would pass around a guitar and sing songs. Interesting little side note is he met Hondo Crouch there.
Oh,
Hondo
really?
Crouch, who is the guy who founded Leukenbach, Texas.
Yeah.
And University of Texas swimming champion.
There you go. Yeah. He was at these parties sometimes. So he gets the guitar playing bug, and evidently by all accounts, once he started playing, it was tough to get him not to do it. and around this time, he starts discovering folk music. The Kingston Trio's big. He starts getting into Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and he and a friend go to Corpus at this time, and they buy a couple of Goya guitars. So he's got a Goya guitar with him as well. Mm-hmm. As a teenager, he's still spending time in Monahans. And he gets even closer to Jack Prigg. Jack gives him his first taste of beer. You know, they're letting him drive his 38 Packard around when he's too drunk. That's going to come up later.
That's going to come up later. Yeah.
I think if you're going to have to drive in a town, that'd be a pretty good one. They have some big, wide, empty streets.
Yeah, yeah. They do.
And
a lot better than Houston.
And Guy says at night, Prigg would go borrow a guitar from the local pawn shop, and they'd sit around his grandmother's kitchen, and Jack Prigg would ask him to play
Red River Valley,
which is his favorite songs. Yeah. His favorite song. So like Kristofferson and like Towns, there are a lot of expectations around Guy Clark. And after he graduates, he ends up getting the National Science Foundation Award, and he goes to work at MD Anderson for a while for the summer.
That's the big, giant hospital in Houston, famous for being top cancer hospital.
Yeah, it's one of the top cancer hospitals in the world.
Yeah.
He ends up going to Kingsville to study at Texas A&I. He studied chemistry, trigonometry, algebra, geometry, and the idea was he'd get a degree in engineering or medicine. But he even admits it was way too ambitious. He didn't do well academically, and he needed time to feed his growing guitar habit, as he says. So he also takes some summer classes at UT. He takes some classes at the University of Houston. He's really not enjoying college other than the English lit classes, and that makes sense considering what his family background was.
Yeah.
He's starting to read people like Kerouac and the other beat poets at the time. So he's starting to get this, you know, think about that young guy, and he's getting this kind of wandering mentality.
That'll get you off track.
Yeah. Sure.
Inspired by Kennedy, he ends up joining the Peace Corps in 1963. He's trained in Rio Bayo. Is that how you pronounce that in Puerto Rico? Probably mispronouncing that wrong. Yeah. Where he's practicing water survival, rock climbing, all sorts of things. He has a month in the University of Minnesota as part of this program as well. He gets an assignment to go to Punjab, India. And he's like, I don't know. I speak Spanish. Why are they doing this? This is strange. So he declines that. And he ends up moving to Houston. And he opens up, while he's there, he opens up a guitar repair shop with his friend Minor Wilson. Those two of them had met as teenagers in Rockport. And they just stayed in touch with each other. And as the guitar repair shop starts expanding, they end up moving. Guy moves into a two-story house with a buddy of his, and the two of them live upstairs, and they move the guitar shop downstairs and work on it. Mm-hmm. And there they need more space, so they start doing that. Guy also starts building instruments. The very first guitar he built was a 12-string made out of poplar. I think Minor Wilson said that he still had that hanging on his wall in an interview I read. I don't know if that's still the case or not, or if that guy's still with us. But while he's in Houston, the other thing, kind of a big thing happens, he starts getting involved in the local folk scene there. And we talked about this when we did the Towns Van Zandt episode. Houston had a pretty robust folk scene. He's not writing songs at this time. He's really kind of playing the
just
standards,
playing the guitar,
and doing whatever. Yeah. But he's honing his skills. And this is where he meets, you know, people like Mickey Newberry, Jerry Jeff Walker, and Towns. The Towns meeting happens because there's a weekly public radio show on KHOU, which is University of Houston's radio station. And there's this guy named Peter Gardner who was in a folk duo called the Gardners in New York. He moves back to Houston and he's doing this this folk show on KHAU, which becomes a pretty important open mic night for all the folkies in Houston. And one day Towns and Jerry come in to do a taping. And they meet there, and then they just keep running into each other. Towns and Guy keep running each other over Houston, and they become immediate friends. Guy says Towns Van Zandt was the funniest, not only one of the smartest guys he ever knew, one of the funniest guys he ever met in his life. And he said when they met, Towns had written essentially two songs, which were Waiting Around to Die and I'll Be Here in the Morning. Can you imagine the first song,
song he wrote?
You write is Waiting Around to Die.
Wow.
Jeez.
Sometimes I don't know where this dirty road is taking me. Sometimes I don't even know the reason why. But I guess I keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. Well, it's easier than just a waiting around to die.
Anyway, in 66, he gets married to a folk singer named Susan Spaugh, and they have a kid named Travis. He's trying to do the 9-to-5 routine as what's expected of him. He works at the art department at a Houston radio station. By 1968, Minor Wilson had moved to San Francisco, and Guy and Susan had essentially split up. You know, like we've talked about this before, like a lot of creative types, he had a real struggle with being a family guy. He really struggled with that.
Yeah.
When Towns was around, he and Guy would pick up one-nighters that were, you know, a day's drive or so away from Houston. And after they're playing this place up in Oklahoma City called the Sword and Stone Coffee House, they end up at the apartment of somebody named Bunny Tally. And her sister's name is Susanna Tally, which we'll play into. Anyway, Guy and Bunny start a long-term relationship. Susanna's sister start a long-term relationship at that point. By 69, he's sick of Houston. And he takes off to join Minor in San Francisco. He moves into Minor's place, which is just a few blocks down the street from the Fillmore West. They pick up where they left off. They start building guitars in San Francisco. Guy helped build an electric mandolin for Johnny Winter when he's up there. And then they start getting a bit of a reputation. And a gentleman by the name of Bob Weir shows up and and asks him to build a single cutaway hollow body.
There's a connection we missed.
Oh, yeah. He builds a guitar for Bob Weir. Yeah,
I was waiting for y'all to say that one.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. I guess I was too patient.
Anyway, they also worked on guitars for Big Brother and the Holding Company, too. So they had some pretty famous clients. Yeah. So I think his guitars are pretty well thought of.
Really?
I don't know, but yeah.
Did he mind if people said he was a craftsman when he was making those?
I think he would probably agree with that. Yeah. I think he saw a difference between the two. Because in an interview, I saw him talking about that. And he said the great thing about guitars and songwriting is they exercise different parts of your brain.
I can see that.
Yeah. So he enjoyed that. But then again, he's very restless. He ends up getting sick of San Francisco and he wants to drive back to Houston. he flies Bunny out to drive back with him to Texas. And she drives back to Texas. I think she ends up getting a bus when they get to Amarillo or something and goes back up to Oklahoma City. In May of that year, Bunny commits suicide.
Oh, gosh.
And Guy goes up to Oklahoma to be with his sister, her sister, Susanna, during this horrible time. 2 weeks later, Jack Prigg dies. And he, I think a couple of days before that, Guy had gone to Monahan's to spend some time with him. And needless to say, he's devastated by that. And over the next month, the two of them bond over this shared grief they have. And they start talking on the phone and just burning the phones up nonstop. And he eventually talks Susanna into moving down to Houston with him. And she does that. She moves down there. And say they fall into the same sort of thing. You know, he's playing folk clubs, doing whatever. By 71, he's almost 30 years old. He's working at another Houston local television station and playing folk clubs, like I said. One night, some scouts from Electra come down to stop at the old quarter where he's playing in search of new talent. They don't necessarily, they aren't super interested in him, but they say to him, hey, if you're ever in L.A., why don't you look us up, right? So that's in the back of his head. Some point later, Susanna's in therapy dealing with her grief. She's trying to figure out what to do next, and she sits Guy down at the kitchen table, and she says, what do you want to do with your life? And he says, I want to make music. And she says, well, I don't think a producer is going to be knocking down your door in Houston. We should go where the producers are. Uh-huh. And so with that idea, the Electra guy is saying L.A., and also she knew somebody, a friend of hers, who a guy named Mason William, who she knew in Oklahoma, who moved to L.A., he had just won 3 Grammys for his song Classical Gas. And he's writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. So based on that and the Electric thing and just wanting to get someplace where the music biz is, they decide they're going to pack up and they're going to move to L.A. And they do that. And so they're in L.A. for a little while. While Guy's there, he works for a Dobro factory. The Dopiero Brothers, it's a Dobro factory in Long Beach. Huh. And what's good about that job is it allows him to go and try to sell his wares. They let him take time off and do it. He didn't have a demo tape. So what he would do is he would just go and grab his guitar and go and sit and sing his songs to music executives. Nobody was really biting that. He also gets a gig with a band called the City Limit String Band. And it's a bluegrass outfit. And there's a guy in that band who plays bass by the name of Skinny Dennis Sanchez, who will also feature in L.A. Freeway. Yeah. And they're playing little folk clubs along the coast. In 71, he gets a meeting with this guy named Gary Tiefer, who's the head of Sunbury Dunbar Publishing, which is the publishing division of RCA Records. And Guy plays him 4 songs, and at the end of the meeting, he's got a contract for $50 a week and a $500 advance. And this guy says, okay, you're going to be a contract writer for us. You got 3 places you can go. You can stay in L.A. if you want to. You can move to New York if you want to, or you can move to Nashville. And he's like, well, thinking about it, and he and Susanna are like, we've had enough of the big cities. So they decide to go to Nashville. Huh. Not only that, he was friends with Mickey Newberry, who he'd met in the Houston folk scene. And that's Mickey is living in Nashville at the time. He had gotten a deal with Acuff Rose. And so he's like, he was considered the first sort of hippie Texan from that group to get accepted by the Nashville people. So he knew that they could live there. RCA tells Guy that he's going to need to bring a demo tape with him. And before he left, he records a 6-song demo tape with Skinny Dennis. And the songs on it are That Old Time Feeling, Step Inside This House, Waitress, Waitress, Texas Goodbyes, Texas Bound, and The Old Mother's Locket Trick. So it's kind of a big deal, at least if you think about legendary things. And this was talked about a lot on that Ken Burns documentary. When mm-hmm. Susanna and Guy Clark get to Nashville, they are like this beacon to young songwriters, especially Texas songwriters.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen right away. They end up living with Mickey Newberry on his houseboat for a while. They end up getting married a year after they move there. Towns Van Zandt's their best man. They get married on the houseboat floating down the river, which is kind of cool.
That's cool.
But they end up getting a house, and their house becomes this sort of center of, I mean, you can see the videos on, what was that, Heartworn Highways? Is that
yeah.
the, the documentary.
Documentary, yeah. There's another one that's made about Susanna that I think you can get on Netflix, or maybe it's on YouTube now, but they talk about that scene very
I don't think we've talked about anyone where their wife is so much a part of the story.
Yeah.
And I thought that before we started researching for this, because you always hear in other people's songs, Susanna and Guy, you always hear about her. I can think of all the pictures where she and he are together. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if there's maybe Johnny Cash and
June Carter.
But yeah. Other than that, it just seems like she pops up so much.
Well, she was an inspiration to a lot of people. Rodney Crowell talks about how when you go to his house, the two
she'd line him out.
Two things you'd want to do is you'd want to impress Guy, and then you'd leave there trying to find a woman like Susanna Clarke, because she was just they all just thought she was amazing.
Yeah, you know? She was kind of a mother figure to a lot of those. Mm-hmm. Those guys.
Well, I heard more than one say that she wouldn't shy from giving them some harsh advice they might not have liked at the time, but they appreciated it later.
Yeah. She was not a quiet woman from what I understand.
No, and there's this one video of them all sitting around a table and they're all liquored up and saying songs, and if you look at her, she's sort of semi-rolling her eyes, just realizing that this is like, okay, this is gonna turn into something, but not necessarily greatness. It's pretty funny. But it's important to talk about Nashville at this time. So you had Kris Kristofferson going there and kind of shaking things up and making people aware that you could write a different kind of country song, one that wasn't about cheating and boozing and doing whatever, a little bit more literary. And Towns was also in Nashville at the time, kind of doing the same thing. And then Guy Clarke gets up there and he's writing the same sort of songs. And then you get these young musicians who they say one of the first bits of advice when they got to town was go find Susanna and Guy.
Yeah.
Go find them and introduce yourselves. And so they were this sort of, I don't know, comforting place where all these songwriters would go and mm-hmm. Bounce ideas off of each other. And also you had the whole outlaw country movement happening at the time. So Nashville starts to get a little bit more savvy to this other side of making music.
Yeah. They're getting away from the Chet Atkins and Billy Sherrill production and stripping down the songs a lot more.
So as you mentioned, I mean, we talked about Rodney Crowell a couple of times. He went up there. Steve Earle is also up there.
Very young Steve Earle.
Yeah. And so I think regularly at those tables, you'd have Guy Clarke, Towns Van Zandt, Mickey Newberry, and then Steve Earle and Rodney Crowell, maybe a few other people. Just that's pretty cool group.
Pretty good group there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think his first songs recorded were The Old Mother's Locket Trick by Harold Lee. I don't know who that is. And A Nickel for the Fiddler was actually recorded by the Everly Brothers in 1972.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. Yeah. That's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Jerry Jeff is really kind of what puts Guy on the map. He takes some of Guy's songs. He takes two of them for his debut album on Decca. Jerry had had three sort of folky albums before he decides he's going to be this country troubadour from Texas and changes his
never personal. Let a day go by.
Yeah, and his
voice changes.
And his and so on that debut on Decca, there are two Guy Clarke songs, L.A. Freeway and That Old Time Feeling.
That old time feeling comes and it goes in the rain like an old man with his checkered dying find the game.
Did y'all notice the word changes he does to Guy Clarke songs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one that struck me was here's to you, old skinny Dennis.
Yeah.
I can hear your bass man singing. Guy Clarke says, I can hear your bass. I can see your bass playing.
Yeah.
Which
he also pluralizes son of a bitch in L.A. Freeway.
That's true.
Which is, I thought was weird why he says it in the plural, but he does.
And then he goes all rawhide on the end of Desperado's waiting for.
Yeah, well, I've never understood why he does that.
What was that?
Yeah.
Well, the guy just is about to die, and we go all rawhide, and we're going to hit him up, roll him out. Well,
he does that, too. It's the same thing he did on Leaving Texas. It's like...
Doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, what happens is because he's starting to get noticed as a songwriter, he gets signed to RCA, because that's where his publishing deals with, to make an album. And this producer by the name of Mike Lipscomb signs him up on the condition that he's going to produce the album. He's 32 years old at this point. And Lipscomb says he wants to do something a little different, a little bit more commercial for Guy. He wants to kind of focus on the Memphis sound with him. Now, it's an eye roller. I don't get it. So he hires the
Stax Records.
Well, he hires the Memphis Boys.
Yeah. And they actually play on this album.
Well, do they do on this version of it?
I don't know if they do on this version of it, but there's some guys that are from the Memphis.
So, yeah. And the Memphis Boys were a group of musical guys put together by Chips Moman, and they had recorded for Elvis, Dusty Springfield, and Dionne Warwick, which I think of all of those when I think of Guy Clark. Right?
Big sounds.
He brings in this drummer named Jerry Kerrigan from Muscle Shoals, and he hires the Muscle Shoals horns to be on this album, too. This is Lipscomb. Guy hates all this. He comes in the studio one day, and he sees all these horns and the arrangements played out, and he's like, nobody asked me about this. Yeah. Nobody asked me about this. Anyway, he says to them, if you guys continue with this and put this out, I'm going to change my name and move elsewhere. I will not do this. So they end up not putting that record out. Lipscomb says that he's on the record as saying that both he and Chet Atkins, surprise, surprise, thought, and Chet Atkins at the time was in charge of RCA's Nashville division, both thought the record should have been released as was. But now, Guy's got a problem. They don't have any money. They blew their wad on doing this Memphis-y, horns-heavy album, and he's got no budget. So what he does is he'd been working with this guy named Neil Wilburn, who ends up being a producer on the old number one that's released, and he was a staff engineer for that Columbia's Quonset Hut studio in Nashville, which is, I think, where, wasn't that where Kris Kristofferson was the janitor?
CBS Records and or CBS Studios.
Yeah,
and,
I think so.
Yeah, I think you're so. Right. Yeah. So he was the janitor there.
Johnny Cash was on that.
Right. And and I think that's where Nashville Skyline was recorded.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy's an engineer there. And so that's where Guy's making his demos. So the two of them sneak into RCA Studio B at night with Guy's demos and a bunch of musician friends of theirs. And they start working on the version of old number one that's released. And that's essentially gets us up to where we are, guys. I know I've talked a lot, but
I want to hear the
horn heavy stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's out there.
I can't put my head around that.
You put LA Freeway with a Memphis horns behind
it. Yeah. I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
Do we want to just briefly talk about the cover?
I think so.
I think we do. It's by his wife, isn't it? It's a painting.
Well, it's not a painting. There's a painting by his wife behind him. Okay. That denim shirt. She painted it because Susanna Clark painted it. She was a very accomplished painter, as we've talked about, also a songwriter in own right, because that was kind of his uniform, was his denim shirt. So she painted this shirt, and then he's standing in front of it on the cover of the album. So
with a denim shirt on.
Yeah, with his uniform on. Again, just, you know, can't emphasize how important she is to the Guy Clark story. I mean, she's a big deal. So yeah, I think his last album, actually, Picture of You, I think, or whatever it is.
My favorite picture of you.
He's holding a picture of her on the album
cover.
He's
holding out his favorite picture of her.
Yeah. You know, it's weird to me. This album was made in 1975. And Jerry Jeff Walker had already had hits with his songs. And it's just, and Jerry Jeff Walker actually wrote the liner notes to the album. It's always odd to me that when songwriters put out albums of their own material, there's been hits for other, you know.
That's the Kris Kristofferson album.
Yeah, Kristofferson the same way.
Carole King,
yeah. So it's always, it's, and I've always wondered why they do that. Do they just feel like they they haven't been interpreted right, or I'm always curious about that. Why somebody would want
to? Well, like, I'm sure there's demand from their record company to put a record out of their own songs.
I think there's that. I think there's also, I don't want to speak for Christopher Sarverson, but I mean, Guy Clark wasn't prolific.
No.
I mean, he...
Well, that's the thing. None of these guys really are. If you look at Townes Van Zandt,
he's much... I saw one interview when they were talking about how much more prolific Guy was than Townes. I mean, he's got more than 10 albums.
13 albums.
But something happens with a lot of these guys is, I mean, Jerry Jeff. Eventually, he stopped writing his own stuff and started interpreting other people's stuff. Same thing with Willie Nelson.
I think
even Christofferson.
There's an age factor. You know, Willie Nelson said, "I don't want to be in that place anymore." You become a big star. It's there's probably not a lot of free time left. I mean, it's the same with anybody. You get busy with life.
Yeah,
a wife, kids, and work. Where's the free time for sitting around and musing? You don't live in a house with five other people and walk out and just sit there and write songs anymore.
But I
think the brain also changes. You know, most of the big physics discoveries are made by people in their 20s.
Yeah.
Unless you're Einstein.
Yeah. He was never in his 20s.
But, I mean, another thing that's surprising is the way that they wanted to interpret these. I mean, we're talking about with the Stax Band horn section.
Well, it's not the way Guy wanted to do it.
I know, but it's just odd to me that that's what they were trying to...
Well, that's impossible to understand coming from our perception of these songs.
Well, it is, and it's funny because, you know, Guy Clark's one of these people, I was going to say one of these guys, who pushed back against being called a country singer, country songwriter forever. He said, "I come from the folk tradition. I'm not a country guy."
Well, he was one of the first guys to get into the Americana to be labeled that.
Yeah. And I think that fits. It's a little broader. I mean,
you know, that lady that wrote the book and made the film that we were talking about, she mentions they needed this term and they came up with it just because there was not a place for these people. Because to call them a folk artist isn't accurate. To call them a country artist isn't accurate. Yeah. Rock and roll doesn't fit. So they needed this term. But it's so broad and it includes so many different type of people, including blues people, that she said, after all this time, I still can't define it.
We're talking about Tamara Saviano, who wrote the book Without Getting Killed or Caught, and also the documentary of the same name about Guy Clark and Susanna Clark.
That was premiered at South by Southwest here in Austin, Texas.
It was.
Which, of course, is one of the reasons we're experts. And that whole hill's about to break loose this weekend, right?
Yeah. I want to kind of talk about this phenomenon of the singer-songwriter. Because I think that, first of all, it's a genre that is, you know, Doug, you talk about the three legs of the stool. You know, you got to know where
tradition, scripture.
No, for songs. Logic. Like, what makes a song compelling? What makes it interesting? Oh. You got the lyrics don't fall off the page when you're reading them. And if it comes from someplace you don't understand. And then you got the kitchen table test. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is, if you're sitting around with an acoustic guitar and you play the song and it's still engages you, that's a good test. To me, this genre of music, that's the only test that it really concerns itself with. That's the only
kitchen table test.
Yeah, they want to test. Yeah, and so I think that this genre gets, I mean, it's easy to produce. You just have to have an acoustic guitar and a microphone. I mean,
unless you want to slather it in horns.
Yeah.
You know,
it's more difficult than it seems, but a lot of people try to do it. And I think there is just a proliferation of
the more stuff you pull off of it, the more important the lyrics and the song.
I was just about to say that. If you
like walking around naked, you have to be in good shape.
If you don't have lyrics that are strong enough to withstand that scrutiny without burying it under a bunch of instrumentation, it's not going to.
But another thing, it's not a music that's steeped in like any sort of mythology or folklore or anything. Most of the time, it is about making kind of the mundane
It's more profound. About personal experiences.
Okay, I agree with that for the most part. But I do think there is a bit of... There's something to these songs in particular.
And
you can't take... Just like with Guy Clark, I think, Living in Nashville, you can't take the Texas out of these songs.
Right. These songs these songs are about Texas, and I don't understand how they would land with anybody. You know?
Well, I think you're right. And there's something about those songwriters. I think I would put Billy Joe Shaver in there too. There's not all of his songs, but some of his songs are so Texan. It's like, how do these resonate outside of people that understand that context?
Well, you know what it reminds me of?
What's that?
That I've always been very curious about King of the Hill.
How did
people in Massachusetts understand this?
Oh, it's my friend was married a Brazilian. And he would go down to Brazil, and he said that King of the Hill was one of the top shows in Brazil, of all places.
Well, because I think probably the Texas-specific stuff on there may be, I don't want to sound pretentious, or maybe over people's heads, but there's general comedy there that people do and other stuff, you know?
Yeah. But the funniest stuff is the... It's like when Hank Hill has to cover his privates with a cactus because he won't use the Texas flag,
or just the stupid stuff, or just very small stuff like the fact that Arlen is essentially Garland without the G and the D at the end of it. You know, I mean, people outside the state
and everything's Tom Lane.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the guy. One thing I was thinking about what you're saying, James, is. Speaking of that stool, if you become really good on your instrument, or if you have an exceptional voice, the singer-songwriter thing goes away, and you become something else. And I think about Clapton has written really good songs,
but that's
Jimi
not what
Hendrix
he's talking about.
Wrote very good songs. People with a great voice will write. Neil Diamond
is a great songwriter.
But you don't hear, ladies and gentlemen, singer songwriter Neil Diamond.
it's a category for a specific type of person, which is basically an acoustic guitar.
Yeah,
and
with the voice,
and it's the stuff of
a person
open
that
mics.
Wouldn't cover someone else's songs.
Right. It's and I've been to so many open mic. It's just like so many people think they can do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're up there, they're singing out, here's a song about my hometown of Iowa. And you're just like,
that's okay,
and
state,
yeah, who cares? I'm sorry, my hometown in Iowa. And you're just like, who cares? You know, or here's a song about the present, you know, political climate. And just all these people are just like, oh, this is so profound and everything. And I just, there is such a proliferation of crap in this genre, I think, that, and especially in the 80s
and 90s. The entry level to this genre is very, very low.
Yeah.
Which
allows, it's a low bar.
A lot of people who don't have anything to say to
get into.
But
a lot of people get recording contracts that do this sort of stuff.
Well, that's because a lot of people like listening to just an acoustic guitar and somebody singing over it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's popular. It's not challenging in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I'm sure the studio times.
Yeah.
It's a cheap studio.
Well, just think about this. They spend all this money on this first version of this album, and then they end up going in with a bunch of demos and throwing some other people over it, and you got this album that's very highly regarded by...
Yep. Yeah,
a lot of people.
Well, he's an exceptional songwriter.
Well, his
we wouldn't be talking about him. By the way, I forgot to mention who picked this album. It was none of us. This is a pick from a listener. Of course, I'm sure it would have come up eventually, but we do appreciate listeners for picking this album.
Yeah. When I say there's a lot of crap on it, it's like this each song is supposed to, it's not nuanced. It's supposed to just kind of give you like, here's a happy song, here's a sad song.
I'll tell you what, though, to be perfectly honest in terms of Guy Clark, I like him. But there is a sameness to a lot of stuff that he writes. Right. I mean, I was listening to this album.
Same with Billy Joe Shaver.
Yeah, exactly. I was listening to this album the other day out in the living room, and Lindsay isn't real familiar with it, and she thought one of the songs was another song.
Yep.
She's like, oh, is that, this sounds like Desperado's Waiting on a Train. I said, no, it's not. It's
well, there's a lot of talking. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's also a lot of, because I'm thinking of like Robert Earl Keane in Copenhagen, and there's just always, hey, I'm so clever with words. Listen to what I'm going to write about, you know, somebody kissing me with Copenhagen in my mouth.
Yeah, I get that. I don't feel that, at least on this album, I don't feel that way. It's funny. I used to be of the opinion that Guy Clark was humorless. I don't know why, because he's not. His songs are.
He looks humorous.
humorless. Maybe it's that. When I saw, I don't know.
Were you, did like you and I see him at the Chicago House together?
Yeah.
He looks like he's 27 feet tall.
Yeah.
And his forehead is about
he looks like 13
feet of that. It's he did look like a big Frankenstein up there.
Yeah.
And that's why he looks so small and skinny on this record compared to what I remember.
Yeah, I always thought of him as a big, tall,
big giant,
but like a discus thrower.
You know, because he's always so serious when he's talking about this, and all the documentaries about him are all so serious about what an artist he is, or whatever. I just had this impression of him, but you can't listen to this music and not understand that there's or get the there's humor in this stuff, and he's you know,
he's more personable on stage, I think. I mean, he introduces the songs, but he doesn't, you know, stay on them forever. Like, and he was a really good guitar player.
He is a good guitar player.
I enjoyed watching him.
No, he definitely is a good guitar player.
He was engaging. He was,
plays
to
like
me,
a craftsman.
He
what?
Plays like a craftsman. Jim, who's on this record?
Well, we've talked about some of them. David Briggs, Mickey Raphael, Emmylou Harris, Steve Earle, Rodney Crowell, the great Johnny Gimbel, Sammy Smith. And one guy I want to talk about is Reggie Young. This is, he's kind of a known for his versatility. He's played on a lot of country albums, but he also was part of the Stax record. He was part of the Memphis Boys.
Okay.
And he's played with Willie Nelson. He played on the Highwayman album. He's also played with Jimmy Buffett. Hard not to play with Jimmy Buffett. We also have a lighter and younger Steve Earle on this. The other person I want to talk about is Larry London. He was a Motown drummer.
Okay.
But he's on this album. He was an Elvis alum.
Okay.
Along with Chip Young was an Elvis alum. He's also played with Adrian Belew.
Cool.
And Barbie Benton.
Oh, very
so
nice.
So he's been around, but he's a very tasteful drummer.
Up first, we have Rita Balloon. Baloo?
Baloo.
Rita Baloo.
Rita Baloo.
She could dance that slow valley shuffle to some cowboy hustle. How she made them trophy buckles shine, shine, shine. Wild-eyed Mexican silver tricking dumb old cousin Willard into thinking that he got her this time.
Where's the hill country?
Not too far from here.
Oh yeah, that's what the Austin people who singer songwriters in Austin, they never talk about east of Austin. It's always west of Austin in the hill country.
Yeah,
that's Kurt where Bell, Hondo and
Fredericksburg, Hondo Crouch is
Luttenbach.
Yeah,
all that stuff.
Well, it's
high
prettier
hill country, right?
It's prettier than east,
and
of
it was
Austin.
Prettier back then. Yeah. When it was just seated
that
choppers
that
out there.
That painting behind you is my daughter painted that watercolor of the hill country.
I thought it was a wolf,
very
man.
Nice. this song kind of typifies what I'm talking about. Just that wordplay, and it's, you know, it's
about something that I find it hard to be engaged with. This is just a woman. I guess she's spent some time in some bar rooms. And,
this is inspired. So when he was younger, the family would go to Garner State Park, and there's these
in the hill country.
In the hill country, and there's these big dances at the dance pavilions.
Yeah.
That's what inspired
on
this
Friday nights,
as well as his favorite teacher in high school was a woman by the name of Martha Ballou. So he
did
gave
she
her
follow
name.
This lifestyle?
I don't
I
know.
Think that would go over well, Monahan's.
I definitely not the hill country.
I don't think this is supposed to be a serious song in terms of trying to get your head wrapped around it.
I don't think so
it's
either.
It's not either.
I think it's fantastic, though. I think it's a great way to open this album. I think it's fun.
I
mean,
I think it's a good way to open it.
I think it's a great way to open the album, and it's got. You can see this woman. You know, he does a very good job of painting a portrait of this woman.
And Garner State Park is a remarkable place, ladies and gentlemen. They have outdoor dances with all these people that just happen to be camping out there.
Yeah.
And in one of the prettiest parts of Texas, right on the Frio River. It's almost to Uvalde.
Yeah.
Which is famous now, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it's a fun little song.
My dad used to play dances out there.
Really? Cool. Yeah. This song's been covered by a number of people. Earl Scruggs Review in 76, Del Reeves in 77, Vince Gill in 1989.
Is that right?
Jack Ingram in 97, and John Denver in 1998. Here's the interesting thing about John Denver.
You got to put the John Denver version in, Jay.
Here's the interesting thing about John Denver. If you go to his website, johndenver.com, and look, it has the lyrics, and then underneath it, it says, written by Vince Gill.
Are you serious?
Yes. Need a new webmaster there.
Yeah, yes. They do.
So it's, I don't, man. Yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot Vince of finger a nice guy. Little finger picking guys like this one.
Yeah.
No, it's a fun little tune. Little character study, I think.
Yeah. The
next song is about Lower Alabama and leaving.
Lower Alabama.
LA Freeway.
Throw out them L.A. papers and that moldy box of vanilla wafers. Adios to all this concrete. Gonna give me some dirt road back street. I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught.
I think I could hear some Mammy Lou.
Yeah. This is a great song. The Jerry Jeff version is just, I mean, I just like that version so much more. And I just love Jerry Jeff. But one thing I'm going to say about Guy Clark, he doesn't have the strongest voice.
No, he doesn't.
But his voice got better as he got older, I thought.
He doesn't. It's funny because I like, of the two songs or the three songs on this album that Jerry Jeff did.
Yeah.
I like Guy Clark's version of two of them, and I when we get to Desperado, I think that Jerry Jeff is superior to the Guy Clark version, but I think Guy Clark's version of this song is better. I don't know why.
It's more personal the way that he delivers it, I guess, because it's his song, but there's just something about the way...
Jerry Jeff has that big, round, deep voice that works... with this semi-talking that goes on during the verses very well.
Yeah.
I agree with Jim. His voice is not a voice I want to hear. I like his songs, but I can't take too... I can't go too long on the voice.
I think...
And I agree. It also got... When it got older, rougher, it sounded
much better.
Yeah. See, I don't mind it on this. I think... Let's take a step back and just talk about, I think this is a fine example of how well this guy can paint a word picture.
Yeah.
There's some things in here I really like. One of the things that drives me crazy is when people use the predictable symbols or what's like the song, what's what I like about Texas.
Yeah.
It has every cliche thing, blue bonnets.
Body surfing on the Frio.
That was just weird. But
Gary P.
This one doesn't do that. The moldy box of vanilla wafers. That's not something you're anticipating, but it's something that paints the picture perfectly because everybody knows.
They're kind of sort of leaving in a hurry sort of thing where you got the pink card, which I don't know if people still do that or not, but used to forward your mail, you know, a pink card that the post office picked, and you just leave in the key in the front door lock, you know? It's
very descriptive.
So you can feel in the lyrics this relief of leaving this place, but also this sort of trepidation about where you're going, which I think is really, really great.
And I spent enough time in LA on those highways. And I remember I had to leave. I was trying to get someone to the airport, and I had to leave 5 hours early. And I was on this freeway that was monstrous. And I thought, why are so many people choosing to live like this?
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Now we're living in that.
I think the instrumentation on this is great. Johnny Gimble's fantastic on this song. Yeah. I think the little punctuations of the piano and the harmonica are good on it. Maybe because the harmonica is fairly subtle on most of these songs, is how you didn't know it was Mickey Raphael.
The piano is one of the highlights on this album.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So many albums like this don't have piano on them.
It's got that Wurlitzer piano on it.
The one thing that bothers me on this particular song is I think the I think on the chorus, the background vocals are just a little much. Like they, if they toned them down just slightly, because everything else on this song is so sort of subtle.
All his friends are in the room.
Yeah,
yeah. I got it. It does seem a little bit like we've got these guys.
Yeah, let's
here.
Use
let's
them.
Use them. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Do you guys know the story of how he came up with the chorus?
No.
Nope.
So, after a long drive with the City Limits string band, that's that band he was in with
Skinny Dennis.
They played at the Mission Beach. It played in Mission Beach at the Heritage Coffee Shop in San Diego. A little brief aside: Tom Waits was the doorman at this folk club,
right?
A coffee shop. Yeah. It's sometime
intimidating presence, yeah, that will certainly keep all the troublemakers out.
Sometime on the drive, like in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he's laid out in the back of Skinny Dennis's station wagon with Susanna, and he's exhausted and probably a little liquored up. And he just jolts up kind of out of the blue and says, "If I could just get off of this LA freeway without getting killed or caught." And then he's like, "Oh, that's good." So he grabs some dirty like hamburger wrapper and Susanna's eyeliner pencil and writes that down as a lyric because he knew he had something he didn't want.
And it ends up being a movie and a book title.
He didn't want to forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, of course, he mentions, as we mentioned, Skinny Dennis in this song. How about the title? You know how the title LA Freeway got? You know that story?
It's not Lower Alabama.
So this song was originally called "Pack Up All Your Dishes." Well, I'll just tell this one real quick. Jerry Jeff's in town, and he's working on that debut for Decca, and he needs some songs to fill out his song list. So guy plays him that old time feeling and pack up your dishes. And Jerry loves them both. So Jerry Jeff loves them both. So he takes both of them. As they're working on the songs, everybody in the studio keeps calling this song "LA Freeway." So he calls up Guy and says, "Hey, you can't call this thing Pack Up Your Dishes. Everyone's calling it LA Freeway. Can we call it LA Freeway?" And Guy Clark's like, "Yeah, we'll do that." One more little funny story. So part of Guy's publishing deal was he had to do demos for the song so that the publishers could go out and shop them around to people. And when he's demoing Pack Up All Your Dishes, RCA is like, "You can't use that line about your landlord being a son of a bitch. That's not going to work. We can't get that on the air." And he goes, the RCA guy's like, "How about son of a gun?" Guy Clark's like, "How about mother effer?" It says that. And so they're like, "Oh, okay. We realize we're not getting anywhere." Of course, it's a moot point once Jerry Jeff records it and gets, because he scored it was number 98. That song was number 98 on the Hot 100 when Jerry Jeff recorded
somebody.
It.
Somebody,
well, you know, son of a gun's worse.
Yeah, it is worse.
Do you know where that comes from? Mm-mm. That's when the ships pull into harbor and they didn't want to lose all their seamen. So they would bring,
ladies, that's a nice way,
temporary wives onto the boat, and they would go to the gun room.
Oh.
So to be told that you're the son of a gun means you're conceived in a gun room.
Yeah.
Which,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure the RCA guy didn't understand.
We need to send that to RCA so they don't make that mistake.
Somebody sings it as Sons of Gunners.
Do they?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a band.
The song's been covered over 100 times.
Wow.
And by a lot of people that don't need to sing it.
Spanky and Our Gang did it. Remember Spanky and Our Gang? Not the kids.
Little Rascal.
There was a band called Spanky and Our Gang. Rodney Foster did it. I'm sure. I haven't heard that, but I'm sure that's a good version.
Yeah.
Roseanne Cash did it in 2015. So anyway, it's a good one.
It is a great song.
Yeah.
And it's followed up by "She Ain't Going Nowhere." That reminds me of a Bobby Dylan song.
Mm-hmm.
"Standing on the gone side of leaving, she found a thumb and stuck it in the breeze. She'll take anything, it's going close to somewhere she can lay down and live it like she'd please. She ain't going nowhere."
There's Emmy Lou.
There she is. Yep. And there's that low chromatic harmonica that's Raphael's
signature. That
this is a very well written song.
How great is that opening line?
It's wonderful.
That opening line is line. "Standing on the gone side of leaving." That is such an amazing line.
That, yeah.
Yeah.
And this song is blessed with those.
You know, and it's a tired subject of the woman getting sick of her life and wanting to move on. But he does it in such a good...
It's so many novel things.
I think what's interesting about it is...
She's looking for something anywhere close to somewhere.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about it, though, is it's not self-pitying at all.
No.
He says she's not crying on her suitcase. It's kind of affirming in a way. He doesn't give any reason why she's leaving. You don't have any idea what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know if he did something.
He said, when he's talking about the song, he said, I wanted to lend the picture that's painted with a sense of dignity.
I mean, you get the idea. There's a woman just sitting on her suitcase trying to figure out where she's going to go, and you don't know why. You know, that, but that's all you know. And he does a really good job of that. You know,
that one verse where it's, and the wind had its way with her hair, and the blues had a way with her smile.
This is one of the best constructed, written.
And then
it's very craftsmanly.
That last line, she's not coming home, or she ain't going home.
What is like a prisoner's, like prisoners have a way with a file? What does that mean, though? I'm not sure what that means.
A file to get out of prison?
No, I know what that means, but
not their file that
now that I'm thinking about her wanting to be untethered, that makes sense now. I wasn't thinking about it that way. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you thought it was that file your teacher used
to
talk
about? No, I thought
about
it was a file, like filing the bars, but I wasn't getting in context of the song, but it just took me a minute to think about it. So also another song covered by several people, including Rodney Crowell and Nancy Griffith. So
That's a better one for Nancy to do than the other one she did.
Yeah.
Well, how about going to the old fair, and they have a nickel for the fiddler. That means violin player.
Well, it's a nickel for the fiddler. It's a nickel for his tune. It's a nickel for the tambourine kind of afternoon. And it's a high holiday on the 21st of June, and it's country music in the park, and everybody's running.
So you cut out before the harmonica came in. How you didn't notice our harmonica on this song. Can, it's so that, I can't even do that.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Huffing that he does.
Yeah.
Where he becomes a rhythm instrument.
Yeah.
This is one of those songs that I'm kind of talking about where
it's a list.
It's a list.
It reminds me again, this is what I like about Texas, where he just cites a list.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying it's
bad.
Of course, I'm talking about probably his most famous song that everybody loves. I think even Dairy Queen used it.
Oh, Gary P. Nunn song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is a list, and I've never liked songs like this.
I haven't either. I like the, High Holiday of the 21st of June. That's I kind of like that line.
I outside of the lyrics, I know that sounds weird talking about Guy Clark. I hear this particular tune and the way it's structured. I hear a ton of people that came after him.
I do too. First person that popped in my head is the Armadillo Jackal by Robert Earl Keane's first album. Yeah.
Well, this maybe that's why it sounds so trite to me. So many people copy.
Yeah, this sounds very like this is a blueprint for people.
That's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So many people think they can. This is what they go.
You know
for.
What this song has that those don't though?
What?
Johnny Gimble.
Yeah.
That's and true. He's great on
he's
it.
Great
he's
on
fantastic.
It's hard to
on
get
it.
Him now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
he's been better.
I bet he got more than a nickel. I think he got more than a nickel for his fiddle.
And this was the song that was covered by the Elder Brothers. Rita Coolidge covered it as well.
Is that right?
She covered a number of these, didn't she? She did Desperados too.
Did she?
Yeah. Anyway, here we go down to that old time feeling.
And that old time feeling goes sneaking down the hall like an old gray cat in winter, keeping
close to the wall.
So I think his voice is perfect for this song.
It works. It's, in this it song. Works for and this song. Is an exceptional song it too.
Is. It's a good it's poetry. Song. This well, song see, this is absolute poetry.
And again, this is a song that is it's so it's not it, it's kind of worn. It's a path that you've gone down lots of times before. There's this kind of wistful feeling for the you know the old times, but the way that he crafts this, sorry, there's the word again. Oh. It just you're there.
There's no cliches.
There's no cliches in it. No.
It's at once nostalgic and remorseful at the same time. Yeah. It's a weird kind of thing.
It makes you sad.
Mm-hmm. It does,
and it reminds me of when we talked about that Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm.
You know, again. Mm-hmm. I wish that there weren't background vocals on this one. I think he could have just done it without that, and that just himself.
I think there's a couple of songs that are
over background.
I think they might have felt like, oh, we've got Emmylou Harris and
Emmylou Harris. She can sing.
How about that
back up
that
the phone book?
Old women without children holding hands with the clock.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's devastating.
This was not the first song he wrote, but he said this is the first song he wrote that he kept.
Well, he did. He knocked it out. And of then the park.
This is a connection.
Yeah, Jerry Jeff did it.
And he did it on Urinating in the Wind. Like that old time feeling. You know, he has a verse about Guy Clark and one about I called that guy to find out what he was anything he's picking now, and he calls up Gary P. Nunn, who's a great guy. That one song.
Here's an interesting other people that covered this. So Roddy Crowell did it. That's not that interesting. David Allan Coe covered this. Yeah. That's a weird.
That's a weird.
Yeah. Well, he did Desperados Waiting on a Train.
That too. Makes more sense than this for David Allan Coe.
I can almost see. What next? Motley Crue?
Well, we get to Texas in 1947.
And we're flipping the album.
Yeah, this is.
Oh, did we just flip?
Yeah, this is.
I missed the
first
flippage.
No, this is the first song on the second side, Texas.
We're flipping, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go second to side left.
Side left. Side R.
Being 6 years old, I had seen some trains before. So it's hard to figure out what I'm at the depot for. Trains are big and black and smoking steam, screaming at the wheels. And bigger than anything they is, at least that's the way she feels. Trains are big and black and smoking louder than July 4. But everybody's acting like this might be something more than just picking up the mail.
Does that sound like anybody to you?
Sounds like a lot of people.
It sounds like Johnny Cash.
I think it sounds like a lot of people that
are in that
red dirt country.
I hear Billy Joe Shaver in that
song.
I mean, it's hard for me to shake that.
Yeah, well, that line, if my feet had been a railroad track, I would have been a train.
Yeah, that I agree with that.
Yeah.
This is about a different kind of train coming to town, and it squishes his nickel for him.
Well, this is actually very autobiographical, because he used to play down at the train station, because he had a friend who was a train master, and he said he noticed one day there was all these people down there, and there was a buzz in the air, and that's because I don't remember what kind of train it was. One of those streamlined trains.
Yeah.
It doesn't even stop. It just goes right through town.
Yeah.
And it was like, woo, you know.
I mean, when you're a kid,
you're in Monahan.
Yeah.
If you're a kid, in San Angelo, we used to do that. There was right by where we would play baseball.
Yeah.
There was the train would come by there, and we would always, you know, like I got in trouble one time because my mom gave me a quarter and she thought I was going to go get a snow cone.
And you put it on the track.
Put it on the track. But,
and they'll derail a train. They used to tell you how you're going to derail a train.
But there's nothing, outside of spaceships or when you're a kid, a train is just one of the most fascinating things.
Well, I think I've said this before. I've had a friend from the UK who I would talk to occasionally in our backyard, and we have train tracks a couple of miles away from us, but you could hear the horn, and he would stop in mid-conversation and go, oh, train. Because they sound different in the U.S. than they do in Europe.
Is that right?
Yeah,
because they go mournful 300 miles an hour in Europe.
Anyway, this is a good little way to start the second side.
I think so.
I think his voice is good on this song, too.
Yeah, I've seen him perform this song just by himself a couple of times, and he does it really
amazing. Yeah, he does the other one about heavy metal, what is it, about the equipment, the big yellow iron
remember.
Anyway, it reminds me of that one we're talking about. Yeah. When these guys talk about heavy metal, they don't mean music.
Something. I mean, it's the same. Or
yeah, you're talking about the big yellow iron pushing dirt around.
Yeah,
that's funny.
Well, that gets us to another train, but this one just comes at the end. Desperado's Waiting for a Train.
And I'd play the Red Ribbon Valley, and he'd sit in the kitchen and cry, run his fingers through 70 years of living, and wonder, Lord, as ever will I drill gone dry. His friends, me and this old man.
All right.
This is such a good song.
This is an absolute masterpiece, this song.
I think this may be the only time I've liked his version.
See, I like Jerry Jeff's mainly because...
I like this one much better.
I like Jerry Jeff's mainly because of the album it's on, and I have such... It's hard for me. I mean,
to me,
Viva Trilingua is such a part of my DNA.
Oh, such a great... Yeah, that's a fantastic album. It's a fantastic song, even when
that's not to say this is a bad... I love this version, but I'm just saying I just have a soft spot.
Well, there's something about the way when Jerry Jeff does it, it's almost like he's... sitting there reciting poetry, and I could just...
Well, the song's poetry.
It is poetry, but it's like he's got a book in his hand.
He's not connected.
No, he's not.
He says, me and this old man were friends.
You can feel it.
Yeah.
You can feel it.
This is...
Jack Prigg.
Yeah, the guy that was at the hotel.
Yeah.
With,
such
this is not made up.
Nope.
This is just well told.
Yeah.
Again, talking about the lyrics, when you get to that, there's a couple of lines that always get to me. That runs his fingers through 70 years of living.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, he said Jack Prigg was bald, but he would rub his hand on his head all the time. So it's not hair. That's why he says 70 years of living. The living is the fact that his hair is gone. And then that line where he says, I went to see him. I was grown and he was almost gone.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's like a gut punch.
What is he talking about? Why is he dressed up like those old men?
I think because he is one of those old men.
Right. He turned into one of them.
And I think it surprised him.
Well, I always thought they started off that he went to a funeral or something, and that's why he was dressed the way he was.
No.
I think Tony's right.
You're right. But I can picture my grandfather when all his friends, they'd all be in those those jumpsuits and all the
play dominoes. I think because he knew this guy over such a big part of his life.
Right.
And he probably
was in his working clothes when he knew him, and now he's in his sit around play dominoes.
Because he went to see him a couple of days before he died, and that's when he died is what transpired to get him to write this song. Okay. And so he's thinking back on all that stuff, and I can't imagine he's sitting at the table with this guy who's so important to him, and it dawns on him, damn, this guy's old.
Yeah
he's like those guys that used to sit down and play dominoes,
and ergo you're getting older too.
You're
starting to realize that you're...
That's us now.
Look at us back at camp.
Say, oh, that's my dad. What's up with the Desperados?
That's what I want to ask. Why is that line in there? I mean, it's the name of the song, obviously, but I don't get that. What's the Desperados Waiting for a Train? Like, it's... I think of a family of people trying to...
All
get
I've been able to come up with is, if you consider, they used to go to the movies together, and you know they're going to cowboy movies together. So for a kid with this old man that's paying attention to him and taking him on little adventures, probably he felt like, yeah, we're just like those desperados waiting on a train. Everything's exciting. That things are happening when I'm with him. You know, but then at the end, when he's about to go, I wonder if it doesn't have a different meaning by that time. I don't know. I've always wondered that about this
every
song.
Time the Jerry Jeff sing it, too. And Jerry Jeff, I think, oversings it when he does,
removed from...
You know who had a problem with that line?
Who?
Towns.
Really?
He said, well, you gone pop country on us now? Because he said, who...
It came after Desperados.
He's like, who repeats... He goes, you don't repeat a line twice in the chorus. That's what Towns was saying to Guy. Yeah. It's like, you don't do that. It's like, you sold out on
it. Well, and right? I don't, the way that it doesn't stick out to me so much.
That
on this
doesn't
one.
Occur to me at all.
Yeah, me neither.
Me either.
It's kind of silly, but
one of the things that does, not in this version, but the way that Jerry Jeff does it, I don't like the way that the Desperados Waiting on a Train comes in at the end of so many verses. And you're just like, no, stop that. Stop that.
I don't know. I like the Jerry Jeff side.
When he starts going, and doing all that, it so makes ridiculous. It sound like it's not about it. It that can take you completely out of the subject.
I get it. I get it. Bobby Bear did a version of this. I haven't heard it, but I bet it's great.
I bet it's not bad.
Of course, the Highwaymen, we talked about that. They had a number 15 hit.
Entirely inappropriate.
What's that, the Highwaymen one? Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I bet it was, too.
They just, everything they do is sound like garbage.
Willie did it in 2011. I wonder what that would sound like.
Yeah, I don't know. He didn't do this one. He is the old man, 2011. Yeah,
except he doesn't have to. He's got marijuana stains, not tobacco.
It's such an amazing song. Close your eyes and see this guy sitting in front of you.
This is the definitive version, as far as I'm concerned, because this is the closest to the story that is compelling. But here comes another great song, another one that Jerry Jeff covered quite well, "Like a Coat from the Cold." Another very well-written song.
This is one of my favorite songs ever written. And I mean, every time I hear it, I get the chills. It's just, it is one of the, it could be my favorite love song. Maybe Girl from the North Country tops it, but it's still just a beautiful song. And you can just such a great image of like a coat from the cold. Just beautiful. So, and I like his version of it. I like the instrumentation on it. Still probably like the Jerry Jeff version a little more, but still, it's just, you can't screw this song up.
I'm not that fond of this song, to be honest with you.
Really?
It's one of my least favorite songs on the album.
That's crazy.
I don't know why. I think in comparison to the other ones, I just don't find it that strong of a song. So maybe I need to listen to it again. That's why I wasn't saying anything. I was just going to sit here and let you guys talk about it.
The thing that's interesting about this song is he's got a pattern or a formula that he's following, and he does it without it becoming stale or contrite. I've danced me around those those saddle situations.
Yeah,
I've taken my share of those sweet invitations. Yeah. It's a very well written song, and this is more like a Kris Kristofferson song.
Yeah, I think
in that anybody could pick this one up.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Just in comparison to the other songs that seem very personal to Guy Clark on this album, this one doesn't. It stands out to me as a bit odd.
It's not as personal.
I think if you think about his for a music guy to have a lifelong romance, mm-hmm. which is so unusual in that world, that maybe makes the idea of that this song is a little more personal because of his. If Steve Earle had written this, which of your six coats are you talking about? But it's a wonderful song, and if I were to pick one to be picked up by people and turned into a hit, that's one I would have picked.
I can't imagine.
I could see that. I don't know.
You could put syrupy strings on this, and you know,
one of the things I love is here we are with the singer songwriter deal that we talked about earlier, and there's a piano playing.
Yeah.
And so many of them act like they've never heard a piano before when it comes to, and it's the appropriate instrument for this song.
Yeah. It's so pretty. And the piano, just, it's such a way David Briggs plays it is so fantastic.
Yeah, it's the piano is a servant to the song. Yeah. It doesn't distract at all.
Right.
And then we have Instant Coffee Blues.
Now he washed all the road dirt from his face and from his neck. Sat down at her table and she picked up his check. And she took him home for reasons that she did not understand. Well, him, he had the answers, but he did not show his hand.
Yeah, it's an interesting song.
I think that the title, Instant Coffee Blues, is... I think that's a great title.
Great title for the subject matter. I think the thing about the song is how palpable it is to feel these people's regret the morning after their one night stand. Right. I mean, they're in the shower and they're just like, and then the idea that you instant coffee is to get the hell out of there as quickly as possible.
It's so perfect. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like this song.
I like it, but I may like it so much because of what you just said.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you have this, oh gosh, this is uncomfortable. This yeah. is no wonder they're having instant coffee.
Right. Yeah.
This is what I don't think I picked that up.
I just thought that it was just, you know, instant coffee is just.
No, so they're trying to pack up and get the hell out of there.
They don't want to stare at each other while it brews.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's really uncomfortable. And you also get a sense of how lonely both of these people are.
You do.
It's not a judging song.
I mean, they're two people that just had one moment together and then they're just totally,
and there's nothing
in common.
And there's no mention of the thing that I like about the song that I find fascinating is there's no real mention of that moment where they find that moment of togetherness where they're not lonely or whatever for that brief second. It's all about the build up to that and then all about what happens afterwards.
It's almost as though neither one of them are using volition. It just happens to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this and the steel guitar on this is just masterful. It's played by this guy named Hal Rugg. I don't know anything about him, but it's just so good.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, very romantic. maybe you'll play it on your anniversary. And that brings us to the last tune on this album, Let It Roll.
Let him roll.
Let him roll. I was listening to Little Feet on the way here.
Mister worked on cars. And it was white port to put that look in his eye. Grown men get when they need to cry. And we sat down on a curb to rest. And his head just fell down on his chest. He says every single day it gets just a little bit harder to handle. And yet... And he lost the thread and his mind got cluttered and the words just rolled off down the gutter. Well, he was elevator man and a cheap...
That's my favorite song in the album.
I'm not surprised.
That's a very, very good song. I'm fascinated.
Is that a talking blues?
Yeah, that's a talking blues.
I'm always fascinated by talking blues. It's just in the way that when he sings.
Is he playing all that guitar?
I think so.
I think so too. It's
very competent.
I mean, I've seen him play this live before and he did it all by himself.
I love the story. That moment in the song where he just so nonchalantly says, "And so he died."
Yeah,
it's perfect. It's so unbelievably poignant. Yeah. I don't know how else to describe it. Right. I think this might be my favorite song just because I'm not as familiar with it as with the other ones. So when I was listening to this album, I hadn't heard it in a while, and I put it, and when it hit, I was like, "I got to hear that again. Yeah. I got to hear that again." Just lyrically, it's a remarkable.
It's about
song.
A man that's life is destroyed by
a prostitute
that doesn't love him back.
Well, she does love him back. She just makes the wrong choice.
Yeah.
He asked her to marry. It sounds like he asked her to marry her several times.
But she didn't want to give up her life.
She didn't want to give up her life. What does he say? What does he call her in the line? She didn't want to stop being a. Oh, it's pretty funny the way he says it. And it's meant to be kind of humorous. So he says it. Anyway.
Yeah.
And then he died. His life is ruined. He becomes a drunk and whatever. His life is ruined. And then he dies, and she shows up at his funeral, yeah, crying her eyes out. It's funny because the way the song is written to me is it makes you think about how their lives could have been different had she said yes, but then you realize there's no way she could have said yes.
Right.
This is the way this story was going to end.
It's kind of like Ruby's Arms by Tom Waits, right? That he just knows he has to leave and he just knows he's not
broken people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thing that is broken is the thing that keeps them apart. Even though from an outsider, you'd say that looks like the perfect solution for both of you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they can't be unbroken.
Right. It's, oh, God.
So there's two things about this song that it's got that quirky wordplay that drives me crazy. And it's a story song. And usually story songs kind of just, you know, bore the crap out of me.
Mm-hmm.
This song does not do any of that. It's, it's so, so good. And there's not, you know, I think of that, was it Caroline by Townes Van Zandt? That's another song that should bore me because it's just a story song. But God, it's
a boo-hooer.
It's a boo-hooer.
I think it really the sort of thing that makes this song so perfect is it's a third person telling the story.
Yeah,
you know, it's
about an elevator operator.
It's an observer, you know, and it makes it absolutely perfect. You know,
it's a good way to end the album, I would say.
Oh, I think so too. I think this song is absolutely remarkable.
And do you take away a moral from this?
Of the song?
Don't love a whore in Dallas.
Yeah. Or probably any town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's it, boys. That is 10 very fine songs by excellent Texas songwriter.
Yeah.
And, this is his first album, so that means what happens next is much bigger than what happened before. So we'll talk a little bit about some of that stuff. But
he became really good friends with Rodney Crowell. I think I think Rodney Crowell kind of played on a lot of his
albums. I think he ended up producing most of his later albums. Yeah. Rodney Crowell did.
Yep, and
he's a pretty good songwriter himself.
Yeah,
and another Texan.
Yep, from Houston.
And his popularity waxed and waned, and his relationship with his wife waxed and waned. How long did they spend apart from one another? They had
it was a long time, like 15 years or something like that.
She sold that song, Come From the Heart, by that Kathy Mattea covered, and I think made a top 10 hit out of it.
I think went to number one.
Went to number one.
Yeah.
So she got enough money from that to go get her own place. And well, she did. But they got back together a long time later. And then she put herself into bed and was afraid to go out.
I think from what I read, and I didn't do a whole lot of like deep dive into this, when Townes died, it shattered her.
That documentary says it just really... Well, it shattered both of them, but especially her.
She talks about how he was, in a way, a rock when their relationship was not doing real great.
Right.
Townes was. I think one of the things
she described him as her soulmate.
Yeah, there was a moment. There was a moment early on in her relationship with Guy where Townes gave her a hug and said, you know, Guy loves you, I love you too. And she said, that was the first time I ever felt like that kind of security in this relationship with Guy was the fact that Townes had said that to her.
Yeah. You know?
And by all accounts, neither one of them were very faithful to each other when Guy was on the road. So
they separated in 1989 and reunited in 1995. Townes died in what, 96 or
something like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. New Year's Day in 96. So pretty soon, Townes died pretty soon after they got
back
together. And
I think she died of cancer, right? Didn't she have cancer or something?
She died of cancer about 10 years ago. Yeah. And then
he didn't last long after
Yeah, he died. I think he'd been diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah, he'd been fighting it for a while.
Yeah, when she died of cancer. And then he died of lymphoma.
Mm.
So in, what was that, 2016?
Well, he put out, 13 albums
yep.
in his lifetime?
Yeah.
well regarded by a whole lot of people. Yeah. Not very commercially successful,
a lot of these guys that start strong like this, they maybe get two or three more, and then you see this long string of one and two star albums. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That doesn't happen in his situation. No.
Well, he's like John Prine in that regard, because John Prine, I thought, always stayed pretty good, a pretty good songwriter.
But not good.
Yeah,
good songs.
That Jesus the Missing Years album that's recorded by with Howie Epstein of the Heartbreakers. That's a different version of different way of hearing his song, but still just great. And I loved watching Guy Clark live, and he usually just was by himself, and he played with that thumb pick,
I just remember at the Cactus Cafe, which is a small, and we were on the front row, and he just seemed like he was
larger than life,
10 feet tall. Everything was big. His hands were big. His feet were big.
Yeah.
That's the impression I got from him. I kept remembering looking at JM and go, this guy can write over and over again. Yeah. This guy can write.
I think we saw Robert Earl Keen at that show too, I think is who else we were seeing.
Was he there too?
Yeah.
We saw him a lot of times.
Yeah. Or maybe it was Towns Van Zandt. I saw Towns.
We saw Towns there too.
I saw Towns and.
That's the venue where Doc Watson told me to shut up.
What were you doing?
He played San Antonio Rose. Can you imagine what I might have done?
And he told you to shut up?
He goes, shut up. And the whole crowd laughed. They were on his side.
I don't know how you play that song and don't get an aha. Were they not Texans in the crowd?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think anybody was there to hear me.
It's interesting because I don't know about Guy Clark's trouble. It doesn't seem like he had troubles with substance abuse much, if at all. I mean, he did stuff early on. There's a story about him and Towns Van Zandt going to Lightnin' Hopkins' dressing room one day, and they're both, and this is in L.A., and Lightnin' Hopkins' California family is there, and they're both absolutely liquored up, and they eventually have to be escorted out of the dressing room. So they did a lot of that stuff. But, I mean, Kris Kristofferson struggled.
Yeah.
Town struggled. But it seems like Guy never had that issue.
And if you saw, I mean, like Doug was saying, he seemed larger than life. And then you saw, I mean, I remember the last time I saw Towns Van Zandt. I mean, he could barely, he even had a microphone and you could barely hear him. Mm. And his guitar playing, he was just like barely strumming his guitar.
And Guy Clark, it was mentioned several times that he took this work really seriously. So, I think that a commitment to work, or at least a job with a schedule, keeps a lot of people out of trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get that.
Well, fellas, this is generally where we give a review. And this was picked by a listener. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I get to start wherever I want. So I believe that I'm going to start with our beloved and humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rope.
All right. So I'm going to go with my critic's review first. This is a fine album of fine songs, and it is very well regarded. And I agree with most critics. This is just a great example of the singer's genre, singer-songwriter genre. There's really nothing wrong with anything on the album. Not a lot of production, which I think is what this album needs. But I think it's a fine album as a critic. My critic's rating is 4.5. Sorry. Okay. My personal rating, this is the one that I'm struggling with. I absolutely love these songs. I sometimes wished I were hearing somebody else singing them. And I just... Even well, with the production,
lucky you. There's so many people that cover these songs. You can,
but they're not covered. They're not covered as well, I think, as some of them. Like, I think there are better versions of some of these songs. But so I'm going to give it this. I'm going to give it a 3.5. But that's very hesitant, just because I listened to this album, then I listened to Texas Cookin', or what's the one after this?
Texas Cookin'.
Texas Cookin'. He seems a little bit more in his element on that song.
Well, these were demos that weren't supposed to be recorded. So maybe going in the studio after he had laid down this foundation makes that a little bit more comfortable. I don't know.
So he just seems a little bit more sure of himself on that album. But so I'm going to give it a 3.5, but that's a hesitant 3.5. I could easily go up to a 4, but...
Thank you, Jonathan Jamro. I'm going to go next since everybody's down to hear what I think. I'm going to give it a 4, personally. The songwriting is pretty close to flawless on most of these songs. There are some types of songs that aren't songs I personally like. I have trouble with more than a few songs with his voice. And I really feel like this album's calling out for horns. That part's not true. On the other hand, as a critic, the songwriting is so strong on this album. I think the production was done right, especially considering that they were using a pre-existing demo. So I give this critically a 4.8, and most of that's on the strength of the songwriting.
I'm easy. I'm a 4.5 on both. I think his voice does not, I don't have a problem with his voice like you guys do. I think the only thing that I have some struggles with some of the production on it. I talked about that, the background singing and stuff like that. But lyrically, this album is so strong. I don't have an issue with his voice. I think instrumentally, for the most part, it's really great. So I think 4.5 sounds right for both scores.
Very good. All right, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we turn to our youngest member.
Barely.
T, what are the kids up to these days? Do you have a recommendation for us?
Well, those are two different questions. I don't know what the kids are up to, but I do have a recommendation. I've talked about this guy in the past when we did our Texas-specific violation podcast. The album I picked was South of Town by Adam Carroll. It was his debut, and I talked about how great I thought he was. I'm going to recommend an album that he released in 2019 called Walked in Them Shoes. The reason why is listening to this Guy Clark album reminded me of how much I think he's probably influenced Adam Carroll in his songwriting and his style. So I'm going to recommend Walked in Them Shoes. I'm going to play a couple of songs. The first song I'm going to play is My Only Good Shirt.
My only good shirt never fails. If it could talk, you know it would tell some tales. I picked it up by the collar. I only paid half a dollar. You might say I bought it on sale. I wore this old shirt at the Ryman. I wore it on cable TV. I wore it in Paris and in Amsterdam. I wore it when I played with my brothers and me. And I had some chicks in my life.
Sorry, T, I got carried away.
That's okay.
That's a good song.
Yeah, and then I'm going to play play the title track as well, Walked in Them Shoes. You'll notice that he announces his songs. This is kind of his MO before he plays them. So here you go.
Walked in Them Shoes. Sometimes it's gold, and so we're told. Sometimes it's not worthwhile. Get an Inman steel guitar and a California smile. Stuck in a Detroit diesel, pretty sure it's a Silver Eagle. The heat's been out.
So anyway, he's guitar playing. He's such a great singer-songwriter, if you will. I don't know if people out there know him as well as they should, so I think it's worth recommending this album, even though we've talked about him before. So again, it's called Walked in Them Shoes. Adam Carroll. It was released in 2019. We'll have a link to it on the website. Check this guy out. He's fantastic.
He is a very good
singer. Nate's horns.
Well, thank you for that great recommendation, Tony. And thank you, listener, for engaging us in another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. Please tell your friends about us, especially if they like the long player format, and we're available on most podcasting platforms. Please visit our group page, our Facebook group page, or email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit www.tappingvinyl.com. You'll find ways to listen to all our past episodes, ways to buy our recommendations or listen to them. There's also links to videos and pictures and anecdotes of the artists that we've talked about. Next week, we're going to be looking at an album by the UK band Aztec Camera, their 1983 debut, Highland Hard Rain. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, thanks for listening, and let them roll.
No, I don't care if it's the president. I'm busy.
Sorry, fellas.